Welcome to the Leadership Raccoon, where we overcome barriers to leadership the cunning way. Today, I'm with my co-host and our lead raccoon, Mike Mears. Mike is a Harvard Business School graduate, West Point, and also founded the leadership school at the CIA. So I say that just so you know, Mike is an expert on leadership, and we're here to talk about all things leadership at the Leadership Raccoon. Today, very interesting topic. We kind of are moving our way across Mike's elements. And if you haven't seen the periodic table of elements, again, I'll kind of bring it up. It is a table, instead of a scientific, it's leadership elements. Very simple. On the left, you're starting with some of the more emotional elements. How do you inspire? How do you motivate? How do you lead? We've talked about all those almost already, Mike, on our podcast, our last 9 podcasts, passion, vision. And now we're moving into some of the more hands-on things. Solving problems is what we're going to talk about today. So, Mike, I have a quote to kind of kick us off, and I want to get your thoughts on. Albert Einstein once said, "If I were given 1 hour to save the planet, I would spend 59 minutes defining the problem and 1 minute resolving it."
And you know, that's right on. I used to be involved with Jack Welch on his Six Sigma effort. And what that was simply a really methodical way to go after process problems, which can be pretty, pretty complicated. Yeah. It's a focused way to go after bureaucracy. It follows certain steps. One of them is define the problem. That's right. The first step, obviously. Measure things. Obviously, get some numbers, and we'll talk about that after a while. Analyze it, and then implement a solution, and then control the solution, right? Well, what we found at GE during that era was that most mistakes were made at the defined stage. And,
okay.
And I've seen that in government, whether it's Department of Defense or the intelligence agencies, and I've certainly seen it in the private sector. And the reason for that is our brains are hardwired to jump to conclusions.
Exactly.
And this the reason we're talking about define the problem here is it's to warn our listeners to take a little extra time and reflect before jumping, because things always seem to be a little more complicated than we first think.
So just as an example, last week in a staff meeting, someone brings up an issue. And I think we probably spent 30 seconds on the issue and 30 minutes on solutions. And I was thinking about that when I was thinking about our podcast today. I thought, wow, I've got to do a better job stepping up. And this is something actually I will admit I am guilty of. I love solutions. I love solving problems. But what I've learned the hard way is sometimes I'm solving the wrong problems because I have not done the work to define the problem. So when you jump right in and your mind goes, oh, I know what to do. Here's my thought, Mike. When you think about a problem, your initial reaction is going to be something you've done before. It's going to be maybe some new technology you learned about and you're excited about. You're trying to solve things with either what's right in your head, the top of your head, or what you know, basically. And is that the right way?
Absolutely. And you remember, it's like the old saying, if you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. So that's what you just said, basically. Mm-hmm. It's your experience and so on. I'll show you how tricky this stuff is. I have a colleague named Chuck Appleby who does something called action learning. And there's actually two definitions of this action learning. But his definition is where you get a group of people together. One of the people in the group has a problem. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the group will ask questions to that person. They can only ask questions.
Nice.
They cannot offer solutions.
I love
that.
Can't,
and it's... It's stunningly powerful because I've seen him go for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and inevitably the idea of what is the problem is almost always altered. As the individual goes through those questions, because questions are so powerful, they lock your mind in place. They're much more powerful than you just giving me advice. And the person that's in the hot seat takes all that in, keeps thinking about it, has a lot of insights, and suddenly realizes, oh my goodness, this problem is either bigger than I thought, simpler than I thought, or it's a totally different issue.
Sounds kind of like applying a Lean Six Sigma technique, the five whys. Very simple. technique, but five whys to solve a problem.
Which is extraordinarily powerful. I work with a lot of executives, and whenever one of them says to me, I'm thinking of doing a reorganization, I always ask why.
Yeah.
And you'll get some answer. You ask why again. Go down the list of five whys, mm-hmm. and inevitably you get to the bottom, which is we need more collaboration. We need to be more agile. Mm-hmm. We need more innovation. It's some soft issue at the bottom,
yes.
which can't be cured by obviously changing your wiring diagram in your organization. It's mm-hmm. got to be. That's a cultural issue. Mm-hmm. You got to attack that a different way. Here's a last example on that. Another way to describe action learning, the second meaning, is when you take a course, let's say you take a week-long course on leadership or management, inevitably the good ones will have some action learning aspect, which is you have to work on a live problem mm-hmm. with a group, and by the end of the session, maybe you're only working 1 hour a day on it, 2 hours a day, but at the end of the session, you do a report out on having solved this problem. We were doing that once, and a woman that was getting ready to kind of midway in the process, I asked her what was her problem. She said, "Oh, we don't have her unit. We don't have an employee handbook," and so that's a little puzzling. It sounds like a pretty simple problem,
right?
And I asked her, I used your method of the five whys. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you need a employee had, "Oh, well, we don't have one." Well, why is it that you need one? Well, you know, morale's low in the unit. So she had already jumped from a low morale unit to, if we only had an employee handbook, they would have all the information they need.
And that would improve morale.
And that would improve morale. So you can see how that's an extreme case, but we all do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a couple of examples, Mike. I was reading, doing some research for our discussion today. Harvard Business Review article on defining the problem. Let me give you an example, Mike. So this is called the Subarctic Oil Problem. So more than 20 years after the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill, cleanup teams operating in subarctic waters still struggled because oil was so viscous at low temperatures that it was difficult to pump from barges to onshore collection stations. So the challenge that they had, how do we frame that problem? Because what they wanted, they wanted help from everywhere. They didn't want just oil companies and disaster relief to come in and solve their problem, because they've done that. How do we frame the problem so that we can get a lot of smart people to give us ideas? So this is how they frame the problem. In its search for a solution, the Oil Spill Recovery Institute framed the problem as one of material viscosity rather than oil cleanup, and used language that was not specific to the petroleum industry. The goal was to attract novel suggestions from many fields. This is what happened. A chemist in the cement industry was awarded $20,000 for proposing a modification of commercially available construction equipment that would vibrate the frozen oil, keeping it fluid. I thought that was really interesting, because they could have gone so many paths right there. Huge problem. How do you define the problem? And your definition of the problem, your solution is closely related to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a whole field called Wicked Problems. And I've worked with Sandia National Labs has a great program on that, where you could take any problem that seems unsolvable from this on up to even more difficult things like world hunger and so on. The trick is getting people together who are mostly laymen. Mm-hmm. And the reason is they don't have a vested interest in the problem. They don't have preconceived notions. They can think more broadly. Mm-hmm. And then you have some experts in the group, but you got to be very careful, because an expert will go down to a 30,000-foot dive, right? And drive the conversation to what they know, mm-hmm. and you've got to keep it out. So you have to keep the discussions going broadly to pick up and better define what is this issue that we're trying to fix here?
Right, because I mean, how you define it, and those questions you ask yourself are going to frame the rest of it. So if you start off and you don't define the problem correctly, when you get to implementation, like, wait, we're not solving the problem. We solved maybe some other problems, then maybe those problems probably weren't as pressing as the one you needed to solve, though, right?
Right.
So you go down this path and like, oh, it does not go back to what we were trying to do. What happened?
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot. And even if you manage a project great, and you've managed scope and you manage requirements, if that problem definition is not correct, you're not getting the solution at the end.
Absolutely.
So, Mike, now that we have defined our problem, the next step is to measure the problem. And can you talk to us a little bit about some of the best practices for measuring? And I'm guessing this entire area for you is kind of fascinating because it's changed so much in the last just 10 years, the availability of data and the ability to measure data and graphical representation of data, visualization of data has just taken such a leap in the last 5 years. But when we talk about measuring the problem, what are some things that our listeners should do at this step?
You know, I would say you're right. We have deep data and so forth. I work closely with a company in that area, and they're miraculous things that can be done with that, with artificial intelligence. But I'd like to get it down to kind of ground level, what the average person could do on measurements. And I truly believe you can measure anything if you put your mind to it. And then the second point I'd like to make is that while this sounds a little geeky, we're talking about solving problems and gathering numbers and all that.
Yeah.
You can do it for soft ends, and you should do it for soft ends. In other words, you should think about how do you measure things in your organization that can make people's lives better.
Right.
How do we improve employee morale? How do you measure that? Mm-hmm. How do we increase the number of good bosses versus bad bosses in a given organization? Which incidentally is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
You can use measurements. You can use certain statistics, pull them out, and learn a lot about an organization. And again, to help you with changing culture and working with people. That's the hard side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you talk about measures, there's only four things that you can measure, which are efficiency and effectiveness,
okay. And
then quality and quantity. And if you make a little matrix, that gives you four boxes, so you can measure quantity of effectiveness or quantity of effectiveness and so on. Effectiveness meaning output,
right?
And then the efficiency side is really time is a overlooked statistic that is wonderful for anybody, an employee or supervisor, anything. You can always pick up time measures.
Yep.
How long does it take me on average to get this piece of paper approved, going through the system? So you can get a median time.
Yep.
But you also need to get what's the shortest amount of time that it takes me to get it through? And you want to pick up the longest because that shows you the variability. The more variable that time measure is, the worse the process, basically. But time is absolutely great measure. How much my employees' days is spent answering, you know, mediocre emails, or tied up in meetings, and then you gather that data, and that can tell you a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Another example is we do a lot of, in my world, workflow automation. So we're standardizing processes, hopefully, the best we can.
Yep.
And then we're applying them to systems where now we can measure. So let's say an HR process like onboarding. Previously, we didn't measure that. It just happened. Now we've implemented tools and you can actually measure onboarding. How long did it take them to get their equipment? How long did it take the person to get their first briefing? How long before they got their first performance management? You can start to look at things and find bottlenecks through the data. And once you find those bottlenecks, now you can start solving problems with measurement.
And one trick to use on that is, for example, on onboarding. That's really important. Let's say you hire new employees. Mm-hmm. You got a new employee coming into your unit. You want to make it as pleasant for them as possible. So one way to do that is not to get so wrapped up in trying to measure the intricacies of the process, but put yourself in the place of the thing that is being processed.
Mm.
So on the first example, remember I told you we were trying to get some authorization through on a piece of paper.
Yep.
Pretend you're that piece of paper and then watch yourself go through each step. Mm. And that'll help you track the steps. You'll see where the bottlenecks are and so forth. On the onboarding, pretend you're that new hire.
Yep.
and analyze 10, 15, 20 new hires, what happens to them in that process, amount of time, and so on. And then all some nice solutions can drop out of that approach.
I think a mistake that a lot of companies make is they skip that process. They skip that benchmarking piece. They skip that, let's get the as-is process defined. Maybe they think we don't have money, we don't have time, we've got to get this done. And I always come back and say, we can't get to the future state if I don't know the current state. You got to measure it. You got to understand what you're doing and use some of the, maybe the Lean Six Sigma tools, the root cause analysis, your fishbone diagrams, your different brainstorming activities, the structured brainstorming.
Right.
Lean Six Sigma does a great job. There's a lot of great tools out there. I've taught a lot of Lean Six Sigma classes. I get to go in there and teach some different sections of them. And just a quick plug for Lean Six Sigma. It's one of the few trainings where every time I have a class, they are engaged the entire time. Because every section that you're going over, define, measure, assess, implement, control, if you go through that model, there is a tool, a template, or a process that you will learn. You'll go, I can use that. So that's just my plug for Lean Six Sigma. You will find something, and it's not that hard to do. Back to this. So we have defined the problem. We have measure the problem. Anything else on measurement before we go into implement?
Two other things. Yeah. One of them is if you're having trouble with some of your measures, don't forget, if you get bogged down, you may have to go back to step one, which was define that problem. Mm-hmm. We already talked about that, but this is where it will show up.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're starting to gather data, once you're starting to brainstorm solutions, if they don't really address the issue, then you got to go back to step one.
That's a great point.
And then the last thing I'd like to point out again is back to my feeling that you can, I agree with you completely on Lean Sigma, but you can do this not like Jack Welch started it when mm-hmm. I worked for him, which was to reduce headcount. You could turn that whole concept up on its head, and you could do this to make people's lives better mm-hmm. and easier, right? And I'll give you a couple examples. How do you measure things, soft things like culture or numbers of percent of bad bosses, for example, mm-hmm. in an organization? It just seems like you couldn't collect that, right? Well, you can.
Mm-hmm.
You can, anytime you have 20 people in a room, in a given organization, assuming they're somewhat randomly selected, like
right.
a training class or something, you can have them list out every boss they've had in that organization, rank them 1 to 5, great down to awful, and then turn in the rankings, not the names of the, mm-hmm. the bad bosses they actually had. You don't want that, but get that ranking, and it'll tell you, do you have 8%? Poor and awful bosses in your organization. By the way, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you have 20 to 25%? And let me tell you, that means that organization is starting to lug. Very
right.
difficult to change culture and become a better organization. But you can see how that's measuring a soft thing
yep.
By using metrics.
I love that. I love when you take a soft area. People go, we can only use qualitative with that. We're not really going to get any hard data. No. Use a Likert scale. Use a survey tool. Well, if done correctly, a professional that knows how to do surveying and understands scales, you can get quantitative data out of anything, I believe, right? I mean,
right.
not anything, but in my world, project, let's shift to implement. When we're implementing a solution, we will use surveys to gauge how ready our group is for a particular project. Are they aware of it? Are they mm-hmm. knowledgeable? Are they informed? Are they willing to support it? These are questions that through a survey we can say 50% strongly agree that they will support this project once it goes live. Not a great number, but at least I know now.
Right.
At least I have
exactly.
a number.
That's what better than not going blindly, right?
Exactly. That's what I tell my executive sponsors and my teams. Don't be afraid of the data. And this can be a conflict of interest sometimes if you're mm-hmm. a consultant. Well, if we get this data and it says we didn't do well, we can't share that with the client. Yes, you can. Because if that data says that only 30% of the people are supporting this project and you're going live in a couple of weeks, it's time for drastic action. You should have been doing action before. And your job is to tell the client, hey, we tried A, B, and C. It's not working like we thought. But we're going to try D, E, and F now because we've learned from the data. Just use that data and turn it into a positive instead of being afraid of that data. My little plug for data.
I'm reminded at old Toyota when they were really at their peak. They got so good that rarely would they get a letter of complaint in.
Mm-hmm.
And once they got to the point where a letter would come in of complaint, how do you think they would respond? Anger, blamed somebody?
I'm thinking they would take it seriously.
They would ring a bell and pull together everybody in the office and have a celebration. Look, we have a way to get better. We finally found a customer problem that we can address, mm-hmm. and we can get even better. Is that pretty cool?
That's culture, right?
Yeah.
That's a culture of understanding and problem solving, not a culture of there's a problem, who do we blame?
Exactly.
And which one do you find more often?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
So when we get into implementing a solution, something that I've been doing a lot in the last 15 years, implementing a solution, a number of challenges. So you've come up with a great problem definition. You've analyzed it. And you think, wow, I'm going to make a huge difference in this organization. I am pumped up. Let's go roll this out. And it falls flat, right? You have to understand that any change, whether you perceive it as great, amazing, the person sitting across from you doesn't care probably. Even if it makes their world better, right? Because a change is stressful. A change results in me being unsure. And you have to manage that. I think one of the most powerful slides I share with executives is the change curve. When you show them, we're going to do this project that you think is the greatest thing ever. And I love it. Thank you. I love your passion, leader. But no matter what we do, when we start to implement this, your production is going down. Because people are going, whoa, what's this? What's going on? Right? Your job, my job actually, is to minimize that dip. I'm going to say, look, if we do this right, this dip in production is going to be this small amount, not this big crater we're going to go down for months. That's through effective change management. And I think when you talk about implementation, that gets left out maybe. I think nowadays, as we do a better job, people are aware of communication and change. But in my experience, that's where you fall short, is not preparing your audience, one. And number two, and I cannot understate this enough, you have to have executive buy-in and leadership buy-in across the board, not just a nod of the head. Like, I will stand in front of my group and say, I support this project. That's the level I want. For those two basics, before anything else, that's assuming you have a great product, just to get your implementation off the ground. Am I right?
Absolutely. And I'll give you, in closing, just two examples. One, every time I run into John Cotter, who wrote Leading Change, he's a leadership guru. I joke with him and say, hey, John, I'm thinking of doing a reorganization. What's my first step?
Yeah.
And he laughs. But he always says, you have to have a unified, committed leadership team at the top.
Yep.
Right? So you do, if it's going to be corporate-wide change. Don't let that stop you if you're an employee, though, because you can change your world, your
good
immediate
point.
World.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be discouraged. The second point you're making is this idea of buy-in. There's some interesting brain work that on change resistance, where we think we are not change resistant, but everybody else is. The reason is that our assumptions, biases, and experiences have caused us to have insight.
Mm-hmm.
And insight produces dopamine, which helps us overcome change resistance, right? So we've had an insight over something somebody else hasn't.
Right.
And therefore, we think they are resistant to change.
Mm.
In their mind, they've had insights on things you've never thought of, and they think the opposite. So the big antidote for all this is back to getting buy-in, if it's done corporate-wide, is really include everybody in the process that you can.
As early as possible.
And this was learned in Motorola when they developed Six Sigma. Mm-hmm. They found they could solve any problem with Pareto charts and fishbone mm-hmm. diagrams and all of that, but they couldn't implement the changes. And then they said, okay, well, what we'll do, we'll hijack the employees and make them part of it,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll get buy-in and we'll have better implementation. Well, they did that, and what they found, not only did the employees have buy-in for the change, they got better solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But why? Because who better than the employees at the bottom who are actually working on the process or the problem
right.
know what's really going on?
100%.
So always involve others, and that's one of our four big leadership pillars
mm-hmm.
That I've always seen great leaders do.
So that is our discussion on problem solving in our blog. There's going to be a lot more detail in here. I'm going to be sharing some personal examples, some screenshots of things that we have worked on. So a little bit longer blog, definitely on this topic, but I think it deserves it. So, you know, be on the lookout for that blog and this upcoming podcast. You can find us at theleadershipraccoon.com, Twitter, LinkedIn.